You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Songwriter and educator Phil Goldston returns to the show this week. He's written hundreds of songs that have been recorded by some of the world's greatest musical talents. His best-known song is probably this one.
Sometimes the snow.
That's Vanessa Williams' massive 1992 hit, Save the Best for Last, written by my guest, Phil Goldston, along with Wendy Waldman and John Lind. Phil Goldston founded the songwriting program at NYU, where he teaches songwriting and is the director of songwriting. Phil Goldston, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
I want to ask you about songwriting styles. You know, when you listen to contemporary songwriters, their songs all have a certain, I mean, you can tell when it's a James Taylor song or a Joni Mitchell song because they all sound like that artist. Do you have a songwriting style? Could somebody identify your songs by you?
I've had friends who for example, in the premiere of the musical Kurt Elling and I are writing, The Big Blind, I had a very knowledgeable colleague with whom I worked for a long time come backstage after the show, and he said, let me guess, such and such a song is one you started. I said, that's right. He said, I knew it. I knew it was yours. Of course, this was someone I worked with a lot. I think you could probably say that, but I think that's not to say my style is that distinctive.
Yeah.
Not as distinctive as Joni Mitchell saying, but it is to say that there are certain tools that I employ on a pretty consistent basis. I like to say about songwriting, there are no rules, there are only tools. So there are some, and some of them are harmonic, and some of them are structural, and some of them are melodic. You know, if you look at the different tools, but at least in my own mind, the broader answer to your question is that when my former partner Peter Tom and I, who made two albums together in the late 70s, when two events kind of delineate this for me. The first is that our manager called us after the release of our first album and said, well, I've got really good news. We said, what? He said, there's a review of your album in GQ magazine. And we said, well, that is good news. Is the review good? She said, well, that's not as good news. But but it was largely positive. But buried
a bad review is better than being ignored.
Very true. Yeah. And buried within it was the statement by the critic, these guys can't seem to figure out who they are. One song is rock, one song is R&B, one song is country, one song. And I remember Peter and I sitting there when the review arrived and reading that, and we looked at each other and we said, no, that's exactly who we're trying to be. Which leads to this story. When I've been asked many times, particularly by young people, what was the best day of your career? Or hopefully, what was the best day so far of your career? And, you know, was it Grammy nomination for Song of the Year? Was it number one? Was it multi-platinum this? Was it, you know, et cetera? good news is I have a number of those events I could point to. But my answer, I realized over time, is that the best day of my career in many respects from a songwriting point of view, and I identify as a songwriter first and foremost, was the day I stopped trying to be a performer. Because that was the day that I was free to write whatever I wanted to write. And that has been such a gift, particularly as I've watched many of my contemporaries and now younger people struggle with a music field that is so market driven that if they step outside of it, they're condemned by somebody or criticized. Or, I mean, this leads us to the discussion, we don't have to go there, of that dreaded term authentic or authenticity, where the idea amongst many members of the younger audience, probably two generations worth, is that there's something inherently better about a song written by the person who's performing it, which I would challenge. I do challenge all the time in the classroom.
I mean, that's something, right, that happened with the Beatles and Bob Dylan. I mean, before the Elvis Presley never wrote a song and nobody expected him to write one, and Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. But nowadays, and in those days, you know, you could have a song and you could get the version you wanted. You get the Perry Como version or the Doris Day version. Okay. But nobody does Firework but Katy Perry. You can't get the Ariana Grande version.
That's a very good point. And there are many interesting threads running through this discussion and this thinking. For example, when you identify Dylan, and I would put him first, when you identify Dylan as the source of this thinking, I'm not saying Dylan thought this way. If you read Chronicles, he tells this great story about going to a showbiz party. You and I have talked about this before. Went to a showbiz party in New York, and there was no folk or contemporary popular music elite. He's there, and he feels like a fish out of water, and Eartha the Kid is there, and Harry Belafonte is there, and there are people from the theater. And he looks across the room, and there is Mike Seeger. And he thinks to himself, or as he recounts it in the book, he thinks to himself, well, Mike, he's good. And he writes his own songs. Wait a minute. Maybe I should write my own songs. And that's why when you look at the first Dylan album, he wrote one, I forget, one or two.
Yeah, one song, yeah.
And then it begins to change. But anyway, that's a slight tangent. My point was this. If Dylan, Lennon and McCartney, Jagger, Richards, to cite three main sources here. If the quote unquote authenticity of their songs was important, it was because it was tied to a new viewpoint, musical, lyrical, and beyond, tied to records too. And that made a lot of sense to me. Although the Beatles, of course, were really great A&R people for themselves. They were really amazing at choosing songs and the stories as Mark Lewisohn in particular presents them in his the first volume of the biography of them going to NEMS, the store that Brian Epstein's family owned, and auditioning records in the listening room just so they could write down the lyrics and try to remember the chords. They didn't have money to buy the records. Okay, so the one great thing about the Beatles and the Stones was that most people think that the Beatles were writing songs, or Lennon and McCartney were writing songs, and they were, for example, performing them in this incredibly rigorous internship they went through in Hamburg in the north of Britain. But of course they weren't. They almost never played their own songs. They did write songs, but they didn't play them because their job was to mock show, make show, get the audience on the floor. Jagger and Richards didn't want to write songs. They didn't see themselves. They were blues traditionalists. It was the whole foundation. Even though it was Brian Jones' band, it was the whole foundation of Jagger and Richards' partnership. And Andrew Lou Goldham, their amazing manager, had to force them into it, into writing songs. In fact, even the first song they wrote, As Tears Go By, they didn't write for themselves. They weren't sure they wanted to write one for themselves. But anyway, if the source of identifying them as authentic was that they represented a new and unique viewpoint. And by the way, one really interesting illustration of that point is Lennon McCartney's first hit songs were in 1962. It wasn't until late 66 that anybody recorded one of their songs as a serious attempt to interpret it. Right before that, it was the Holly Ridge Strings perform the Beatles, where George Martin did orchestral variations of a couple on the flip side of the American version of Help, that kind of stuff. But when Judy Collins recorded In My Life and called the album In My Life and captured something that Lennon was after, but didn't get in the Beatles record because the Beatles on balance on the album, they thought they needed an up-tempo song. So they did In My Life much faster than he recorded. The same thing happened with the song Help, of course, but that was before. But anyway, my point is that that's an indication that the most important musical act of those 4 years, or certainly three and a half of them, were people who wrote their own songs by and large, but nobody sought to interpret their work. That's really something pretty big about that degree of, okay, I'll use the dreaded word, authenticity. But as the whole pop world explodes and takes over, people like me are writing songs for others. You know, I think I told you years ago the story of going to Madison Square Garden with my family to see Vanessa Williams open for Luther Vandross. She invited us to come. So there we are, we're sitting in the garden, sold out show. It's incredible. She's on stage. She's doing really well. I'm sitting next to our then 9-year-old daughter, Molly. And Vanessa performed 3 songs, which I co-wrote in a row. It was a total thrill. It's great. And then Molly leans over and says, Daddy, Daddy. And I said, What, Molly? And I leaned down. She says, Aren't you mad? And I said, Mad? No, she just did a few of my songs. She said, Yeah, but she said they were her songs and they're your songs.
But they are her songs, right?
That's right. That's what we dream of. Somebody's going to be, how many people must think that Whitney Houston wrote I Will Always Love You?
Or you know, Over the Rainbow is Judy Garland's song.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, let me ask you this. When you're writing a song, I talked with Jimmy Webb once, and although I never talked to Burt Bacharach, I know this is true of him. They wrote records as well as writing songs, and I guess Phil Spector would do that too. That is, he could conceive of the song, Jimmy Webb told me, of how the song would sound coming out of the radio. That's how far he would go with his songwriting, not just I came up with a tune and I came up with lyrics. What about you? How deep do you go when you write a song?
Well, first of all, I think that at this point, it's pretty unlikely that somebody writing in a popular realm wouldn't be thinking that way, because production not only technically has become such a big part of what you do, regardless of the digital audio workstation you're tending to work in, but also because the line was blurred a long time ago. And all this attention of Brian Wilson on his 80th birthday just once again highlights that. But, I mean, and then you go to the 90s, and I remember sitting in the offices of A&R people who choose songs for performers to record. And I remember this young A&R person, I played him a song, a demo of a song, and he said, I really like that record, he said. And I laughed and he said, What's so funny? And I said, Well, that's not a record. That's a demo. You get to decide what the record sounds like. But that didn't necessarily go over that big, Gary. But
well, now, have you had the opportunity? I know you have, of taking a song from inception to production to
many, many times. And anyway, what my answer, I don't mean to be obnoxious about it. My answer is this. The program I lead at NYU, Steinhardt Songwriting, it's really the only major songwriting program there, is one that is devoted to writing, to helping. It's devoted to helping writers who happen to be students become the best songwriters they can be. And so there is a bright line in our program between the words and music and the recording. We do teach both, particularly at the undergraduate level. But if you're in a class with me and a classmate played a song and you said, if I asked for a comment and you said, well, I just love the guitar part on that, I'd stop you and I'd say, hey, Gary, can you tell us, is that guitar part integral to the song? Now, it could be Day Tripper. It is, right? Satisfaction, it is, you know, all of those songs in that ilk. But my dear friend and colleague, Kevin Killen, the great 8-time Grammy award-winning engineer producer, tells a story. We co-teach 2 production courses at NYU, and he tells a great story to the students about working with Bacharach and Elvis Costello. And Bert walked in with a score, band, recorded it, rhythm section, then he overdubbed strings and horns. Now it came down to mixing. And much of the time spent in the finalizing the details of the mix was Bert, what we call muting, eliminating portions of the arrangement. Huh. Every time he would do that, Kevin would say to him, well, that's such a great part. Why are you doing that? And Bert said, no, I'm just trying to get it down to the simplest version I can get. Yeah, I know that's a great, great horn part, but do we really need it? I don't think so. Huh. So that's another way of thinking about this. Anyway, I've written many songs that I either write in the digital audio workstation or I'm already consuming. I'm consuming the process that way, or that the process is consuming me. That said, I've also written, even now, I just finished a song today in which I don't want to think about how the record should sound. I just want to get the words and the music right and the structure right. And then we'll move on to the next phase of things. And I think both can be incredibly valuable to songwriters, incredibly valuable. And by the way, this links to a great comment that Bacharach made years ago in an interview. He said, if you want to be a great songwriter, you might not have said great. If you want to be a good songwriter, you have to learn to get away from your hands. And the interviewer said, why? He said, and remember, Bacharach is a superior pianist. And Bacharach said, well, your hands know what they can do. And I always tell students, but they also know what they can't do. So you're not likely to go to the place. And this is not just melodically, this is harmonically, rhythmically. So it comes down to playing what you hear or writing what you hear instead of hearing what you play or writing what you play. And this is very, very important because I'd like to think that a component of my style is memorable melody. And the reason I think that's important is that's what people whistle in the shower. And I even notice now, I predicted a long time ago that hip hop would not make its appearance in advertising until 2 generations had gone by. And I've made a lot of predictions that are wrong, like Trump's not going to win the presidency. But
that one was correct.
Yes. But I note that the hip hop music I'm hearing is very melodic. No Diggity is the prime one going right now. It's totally melodic.
Yeah, I think there has been a more melodic trend in that kind of music where you, you know, there's a verse and some singing and then some, you know, I think a lot of people made a big deal about Hamilton being such an unusual and, you know, revolutionary Broadway musical, which it absolutely was. But in the same way that Hair was a revolutionary musical at its time, today, when you listen to Hair, you realize, oh, it's just a musical. It just happens to have a veneer of rock and roll around it, but it's not really rock and roll. It's Broadway tunes. And I think that's true of Hamilton also. It is done in a hip hop style, but it's also a lot like Annie Get Your Gun, in that Irving Berlin's songs had that same repeated rhyme scheme.
Yeah, I think however Lin-Manuel puts his stuff together, I think he's aware of that, what you just said. That's my sense. And you know, the men who wrote Hair, Rado and Ragni and
McDermott.
They were, I was going to say a very harsh word, but they weren't of the community. They weren't steeped in that. And you're totally right about Hair. You go back, you listen to it now and you say, well, that's just, it's the window dressing of it. And there's value in that. But you know, the thing about going back to Hair, if you want it, like you and I were just drawing a certain dividing line, in the art and craft of popular song, starting with Dylan and Lennon McCartney in particular. The big thing about Hair is that there's a backbeat in most of the songs. Before that, there is no backbeat really. It's just two. If you want to have an upbeat song, then it was in 2-4. Oompa, 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 oompa. I'm just a girl who can't say no. That's it. It's not, I'm just a girl who, it's not rocked out. And that's a whole difference. It's different culturally. It's African-American versus Anglo. It's, you know, you go on and on and on with this stuff. That's the big dividing line right there.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Getting back now to our conversation with songwriter and educator Phil Galdston.
Well, Phil Galdston, I want to ask you a little bit about the nature of collaboration, which was related to what you were saying earlier. I once heard Paul McCartney, and we know that Paul McCartney wanted the songwriting credit to Yesterday to be changed to have his name first instead of John's. But at the same time, I heard him say that And I Love Her wouldn't be the same song without George's ba-da-da-dum, which George came up with.
That's right.
So shouldn't George, by all accounts, then have a songwriting credit on And I Love Her? But he doesn't.
Well, okay, this is how it works. So first of all, there's the legal. And under the legal definition, I'll give you the explanation of rights. How the definition or the rights are applied is fairly subjective. But here's the idea. If you and I are in a room together and I'm writing a song, you're not a professional songwriter, right? You're a musical guy. And you say to me, gee, do you mind if I give you an idea? I have a thought here. And I say, no, not at all. And you say, I really think these two words should be changed to be this. According to the law, if I accept your contribution, we now divide the rights equally between those who agree to have their contribution memorialized in the song.
So even though you wrote 99.9% of the song, right, and I wrote 1%, we're right, splitting 50-50.
Now, it's not to say we can't agree to a different split. There's the fantastic story of Goffin and King. It's told different ways. The version I like, I'm not sure it's the accurate one. And only Carol is alive to tell us. But I think she tells it this way in her autobiography. She and her then husband and main collaborator, Jerry Goffin, were in a cab on West 57th Street, stuck in traffic. And in the cab going the other way is the co-head of Atlantic Records, Jerry Wexler. And Wexler says, hey, I'm producing Aretha Franklin. Do you guys have a song? I need a song. And they say, well, we'll be happy to write one. And he says, I've got a great title. And they say, what's that? He says, Natural Woman. And they go home and they write this utter classic, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant song. What does Jerry Wexler get? Under the law, he was entitled to get 33. He got 20. Because you can work out other deals, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to be a collaborator as a way of life, which I have been, then you have to be mindful of what collaboration means, how you want to be perceived, how you want to nurture this career, and every single aspect of it, the song being the first one, is related to it. Because if you get I've worked with a few people who come from the contemporary Christian world of music, a world that's known for having a rapacious business side. And I've found that some of the people with whom I've dealt have, even though they're writers, they're carrying on that tradition. They're doing things like counting words. Well, we wrote the song together, but you only wrote the lyrics. And I counted up, there are 36 words and you contributed 9. So that's a quarter of a half. That's what you should. Really? Okay. So, you know, that's the extreme. But one thing I learned, I think I always knew it, but I have to say, I really only grasped it in a profound way for me personally about 10 years ago. And so it's something I tell my students all the time, because our students are forced, quote unquote, they're required to collaborate. We don't tie them up with a bowl of food and bowl of water, but they are required by assignment to collaborate. And they're required to collaborate in groups we assign, at least at first. So I always tell them, look, you're going to have bad experiences. I mean, I've written hit songs with people I never wanted to see again. That can happen. And I've been, I once had a famous British rock star come to my studio. Somebody set this up and he walked in and I was really excited to work with him. And we started fooling around. About half an hour went by and he stood up. He said, you know, this isn't working for me. Nice meeting you. Goodbye. I mean, it happens, right?
Yeah.
So here's what I grasped about 10 years ago. It's probably obvious to you, but it wasn't to me, and I'll explain why. Collaboration is not competition. And the way I came to that was there were a couple of people with whom I wrote for years and years, some people with whom I wrote songs of which I'm very proud, who would regularly say, let's say we reached a point in the writing of a song and my collaborator thought we had it, and I wasn't sure. Now, there are a bunch of people with whom I've written over the years who nicknamed me Option Man because I like to try out different options. But so I would say to this one writer, this one collaborative, longstanding, a man I love, I'd say to him, let's try this. And he'd very often say, no, if you want to try that, go ahead. If you can beat what we have, fine. Otherwise. And he was kind of intimidating to me for a long time. So I would kind of buy that. And generally, I couldn't beat it because either that I wasn't sure what it should be, or maybe I didn't have the chops for that thing. But that's not the point. The point to me was what he should have said, at least in the ideal, is, okay, we have what we have. I think it's great, but I'm willing to go down this lane with you and see what we find. And if my idea is so great, or what I like is so great, that'll be what we go with. But if what we find down here works. And so this gets into a whole concept of songwriting where you have to be courageous to do this. I mean, nobody's going to pat you on the back because nobody's ever going to know how courageous you were. This is internal. You've got to be courageous. You've got to go and be willing. Roseanne Cash, a dear friend, likes to say, you have to be willing to forego the best line in the lyric to improve the song. And that's competition with yourself, right?
Yeah. Well, so although you try to be non-competitive, there's obviously some kind of a competitive spirit in terms of, I want to get a hit record and all that. But let me ask you this. My wife is an artist, and when she looks at other art, well, she's an art snob. Because I'm not just her. I mean, when I listen to other interrogators on the radio talking to people, I think, well, that was terrible. The guy was interesting, but what horrible questions. So what about you? Are you a songwriting snob? Do you hear other songs?
Utterly and totally. but that's not talking about my, I don't want any listener to perceive that as being related to taste. It's not like I'm sitting there saying, James Brown, are you kidding? I adore James Brown. It has nothing to do with that. It's how the tools are used, how the rules are broken. Where is the courage I can perceive? Where is the inventiveness? I love to play in songwriting class. I love to play A Case of You. So it's not only Joni Mitchell's most covered song. I believe it is. I forget how many covers.
Maybe Both Sides Now would probably be your most.
No, I think A Case of You has been covered more. I think it's something like 600 covers. There are 80 covers out there of Save the Best for Last. I'm very proud of that. But 600, 800, whatever, 400, whatever it is, please, that's just saying something. But the reason I like to play that song is not only is it beautiful, not only is it brilliant, not only can I go through it as many others can and say, now let me show you just how good this person is. In the first four lines of this song, you know more about these characters than most songs can ever convey to you. And since songwriting is the musical analog of short story writing, real estate is of the essence. And you need to be economical. You have to decide how economical you want to be. But if you're telling me a story and you can tell me a tremendous amount in four lines without compromising anything, man, now I'm being a snob. That's really, really amazing stuff. But beyond that, a songwriting teacher goes into a room of 100. I never get to go into a room of 100, but goes into a room of 100 writers and says, okay, here's a title I want you to write to. And I do this, by the way, all the time. Here's the title I want you to write to. A Case of You. And I put it on the blackboard. We both know that out of those 100, 90 to 98 people are going to come back with a song that's something about doctor, doctor, help me out. I got a bad case of you, but not her.
Yeah.
So I'm a snob there.
Right. Well, what about when you hear fake rhymes? That's something that I think I hear more in music than I used to. That is when two words don't actually rhyme, but the singer tries to sing them as though they rhyme. The worst ever being Justin Bieber in a song called Mistletoe rhyming the word fire and July.
Yeah. So I'll be a little more gracious than you. They're not fake rhymes. They're imperfect rhymes.
Okay.
There are a number of exact rhymes, imperfect versus imperfect rhymes. But anyway, so I was once talking to the late, remarkable Marilyn Bergman, who was a friend and a bit of a mentor, particularly in the intellectual property area for me. Very, very important. And I revered her work with her husband, Alan. And we were at an event when she was president of ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, of which I'm a lifetime member. And she said, how did you enjoy your term as Berklee College of Music songwriter in residence, which I was named to by the ASCAP Foundation? So that was the connection. And I said, I found it very interesting. I learned a lot. And this before I was teaching actively. It was a building block. And she said, well, Alan and I just came back from Berklee. And I said, oh, gee, that must have been great. She said, she was known for her candor. She said, no, it wasn't. And I said, why not? She said, well, the school is wonderful. And they're doing important work. And look how many great people have come out of there. But I couldn't believe how the songwriters didn't know and didn't seem to really have received instruction in rhyme, in scan. And she went on a whole rant about this. Now, when I got to write with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who were dear friends also, one thing I noticed about Cynthia was that she was not afraid to use an imperfect rhyme, but she was remarkably adept at finding ways to use perfect rhymes. That's how good she is. The Felix Cavalieri of the Young Rascals once said to me, he was making a solo album, and he had written with her, and he was writing with me and a bunch of my contemporaries. And he said, you know, I love your lyrics, because he doesn't really write lyrics very much. And he said, I love your lyrics. I love what you're writing to our music. And I was very flattered. He's one of my heroes. And he said, you know, I got a lyric from Cynthia the other day by fax, and I looked at it and I thought, did Cynthia Weil write this? It really doesn't read that well. And I said, really? And then what happened? He said, I sang it. So that, you know, that's a really, really, really important thing, that there's so few. I'm hard pressed to name any notable critics of popular song who are not writing in the purely musicological kind of academic world, who are capable of writing about music. Grail Marcus and Peter Guralnick, who was just a guest at NYU, fantastic. And those are people who can write about the feeling of music, and they know a lot about how it's done and put together. And, you know, I mean, you couldn't be more deeply knowledgeable, but they're not writing about music from the inside of music. So I bring that up because it's far easier to write about image and lyric theme and statement than it is about the nuts and bolts of music. And I could probably make a direct tie between that and going all the way down to what you asked me about with imperfect rhymes, in that A&R people who make so much of these decisions, at one time, they were, many of them, record producers. Some of them were songwriters, or at least they were deeply attuned to the art and the craft. But that's not so much their job now. And there aren't that many who are really attuned to that. And I have my severe criticisms of that, but I'm not offering that now. I'm just saying, if you look at the culture of the art and craft of song, then what are the messages people are getting, particularly young people? If the message I was getting was be courageous, be exploratory, be different, be new, the message they're getting now is, you know, I'll put it this way. I like to explain to students that my view of songwriting in the popular realm is that we're accepting certain limitations. I call it the inspiration of limitation. So it's like if we said you have to write a blues song. Well, you could go beyond three chords. You can go beyond the basic three chords, but you're not likely to. So now you're in a box. The question is, how interesting can you make the inside of that box? How can you decorate it? How can you, just like if you go into a home and the walls are of one room or two different colors because the light hits them differently, and it gives the illusion that the room is bigger than it is. All of the tools are devoted towards this once you're inside this box. But I'm afraid that the message that many young writers are getting is that that box can only be decorated in a couple of different ways. One of the ways is use three or four chords and only three or four chords. Now, Chain of Fools, written by Don Covey, recorded by Aretha, has one chord.
Eleanor Rigby, I believe, has one chord.
Has two chords. and Stevie Nicks' Dreams, Fleetwood Mac's best-known song, two chords. So I'm not arguing against minimalism harmonically, but look at the stress and the strain that puts on being a melodicist. Some people are great melodicists, Paul McCartney, thank you. So he can make those two chords work. A lot of young people coming up, either they can't or they can't yet.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro on KSEO, and my guest this week is songwriter and educator Phil Goldston.
Let's talk a little bit about contemporary music. I mean, most people are people who are not professional songwriters or musicians are pretty much locked into the music they grew up with. That's the music that they love. And they don't like the music that came before, and they don't like the music that came after. So a lot of people hear contemporary music, let's say a song like WAP, and it sets off a lot of red flags for them. They either don't like it because they don't like it musically, or they object to it lyrically, just as people objected to the words, "I get high with a little help from my friends." People find, "Park your truck in my garage and spit in my mouth" to be offensive.
I wonder why.
So the question is it truly offensive, or is it just simply offensive to people of an earlier generation?
Well, I mean, now we're in at a, I think it's Oliver Wendell Holmes, are we not? I forget the famous Supreme Court decision, which said, "I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it."
Right.
Right. So I can comment on that. First of all, let me point you to an article that came out in the past 2 days that reveals, that presents a study. I'd have to look for where this study is, but it's reputable, that interest in new music, new popular music by the younger audience has declined, and the interest in older music has increased in that audience. That's really fascinating. If at one time you could have said that the airwaves were dominated by the music of baby boomers, because that's where the bulge was in the market, or that's where the dollars were, et cetera, et cetera. The music business long ago pushed that aside, or we wouldn't have so many surviving important artists on their own label or some small label someplace. Record companies have, Sony Legacy Records, or et cetera, et cetera. So it's not about the focus of the labels. That's not what's causing that. Okay, so what else could it be? I'm not saying there isn't some market saturation issue here. I'm sure there is. But I think that the old adage, probably spoken by some parent of a friend of mine, but repeated the world over as time went on. If you're going to take all the clothes off the man or the woman in the photograph, what's going to be left to the imagination? I think applies to some degree here. If Madonna, what was the name of her book with the photographs with
Sex?
Sex. Oh yeah. Gee, I don't know why I couldn't remember that title. And if that's what you're going to do, I don't have a problem with that. But where's the mystery? Does there have to be some mystery? I mean, we can tie this into social media. We can tie this. I think that mystery is a really undervalued quality in show business in general. I think in the culture in general, that's my sense. And a good double entendre, whether park my truck in your garage, a good double entendre or not, not a bad one, but not when it stands next to a whole bunch of metaphors or direct statements that aren't double entendre. Where's the mystery? Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I mean, that's pretty good. That works. And there are a lot like that.
Doing what comes naturally.
There we go. Excellent. Excellent example. I was saying, this is going to be sacrilegious, what I was saying to my wife a couple of weeks ago. Did Rodgers and Hammerstein have an incredible laugh together when Hammerstein walked in with a song called "June Is Busting Out All Over"? Right? Yeah. I mean, the song's not about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that had a chuckle. I have to go look through that biography and see if they did. It's such a gigantic topic, Gary. I love talking about it. I want to make at least one other comment about it. So a few years ago, in the main songwriting course at NYU, I asked the students to please recommend an album we should all listen to for the next week. And these courses courses I teach are by and large practicum or practica. So we don't get a lot of time to analyze the work of others. It's mostly like what I said about a case of you playing a song and saying, see how this tool is used here, et cetera. So we listened to a Kendrick Lamar album and we came back the next week and I said, okay, let's go around the room and talk about the album. What do you like? What don't you like? What's good? What could be better? And they talked about it, and they were wildly enthusiastic. I mean, our students range in age, but this particular group was probably somewhere between 20 and 25, and they loved it. And then one of them said, so what do you think? And I said, well, I think the guy is very gifted. I particularly like that he tackles these topics of great social significance, and I like his angle. And, you know, I'm moved by it. And everything. I said, what I find a little difficult to get by is the misogyny. Don't you? And the men were noticeably silent. And one of the women raised her hand and I said, so what do you think? And I read a line that was distinctly misogynistic. She said, oh, you know, that's just the way people talk. That's just part of the culture. That's, well, you know, how do you deal with that one? How do you? My generation had its examples of calling women chicks or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then
under my thumb.
I'm sorry?
Under my thumb.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Lennon McCartney is getting better.
Yeah.
He used to be cruel to my woman. I beat her and kept her apart from the things that I love, that she loved. Ooh. Well, McCartney has apologized for that. Lennon McCartney has run for your life. I'd rather see a dead little girl than to be with another man, which Lennon copped from somebody else's song. But, you know, we all can grow, which, of course, you know, if you want to take the long view, certainly of what I do, I'm sorry, not of what I do above what others do, but how I think about my work. This is the most important aspect to me. Can I keep growing? So when you ask me about style, as you did at the beginning, well, I hope that the next series of songs you hear from me, I hope there are at least a couple in there that are not like what you've heard from me before. I've just finished two songs with Kurt Elling for his new album with Charlie Hunter, his second album with Charlie Hunter, who's the most remarkable guitarist. And I've never written any songs like this before. That's a total thrill.
Well, Phil Galston, I have a million more questions, and you and I have been having this same conversation now for 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And, we'll have to continue at another time. But
Let's do it.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.